listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As the list of names of dead and wounded at the borders of Gaza continued to climb over the week, the UN Security Council also took note of the continuing fighting in Syria. This was Stefan de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy on Syria, reporting to the Security Council on Wednesday in New York. His report was challenged by a number of others, including Syria's Deputy Permanent Representative. First, Special Envoy de Mistura.
Madam Ambassador, Madam President, thank you very much. When I last briefed the Security Council on the 9th of April, it was an emergency meeting. And on that occasion, I warned of the dangers to regional and international peace and security arising from developments in or related to Syria. Today, it's not an emergency meeting, I know. But the circumstances of an emergency very much remain. Tensions, I don't need to remind you, are high, and regional and international confrontations have occurred several times. Let me just highlight some recent events since the 9th of April. On the 13th of April, the United States, France, and the United Kingdom conducted missile strikes in response to the allegations of chemical weapons used in Eastern Ghouta. Those countries say that the strikes targeted three chemical research and production facilities near Damascus and Homs. On the 29th of April, strikes were reported on Syrian government military facilities in Hama and Aleppo. Some media outlets attributed these strikes to Israel, alleging that those killed included Iranian personnel as well. neither Israel nor Iran responded to those claims. On the 8th of May, strikes were reported just south of Damascus. Syrian state media attributed the strikes to Israel. Israel did not confirm this claim. Israel then said that he had detected, quote-unquote, irregular Iranian activity, unquote, in the occupied Golan, which it put under high alert. Between 9 and 10 May, Israel carried out dozens of strikes against presumed Iranian and Syrian government military targets across southern Syria. Israel authorities claim they were responding to Iranian forces firing rockets from Syrian territory at Israeli military targets in the occupied Syrian Golan. Iran condemned Israeli strikes and denied these claims. We are not in a position to independently verify every aspect of these incidents, but frankly, even an incomplete picture demonstrates a troubling trajectory of a ever more frequent and ever more intense international confrontations over Syria, unprecedented since 1973. The Secretary General has followed these developments, you know it, with great concern and has called for restraint for all parties to avoid any acts that could escalate the situation and worsen the suffering of the Syrian people. The Secretary General stressed that the UN has, quote, a duty to remind all parties of the obligation, particularly when dealing with matters of peace and security, to act consistently with the Charter of the UN and with international law in general, unquote. And on the issue of chemical weapons, let me again echo the Secretary General's call for this Council to, quote, agree on a dedicated mechanism for effective accountability for the use of chemical weapons in Syria, unquote. As of now, as you know very well, we are awaiting the results of the ongoing investigation by the OPCW fact-finding mission following their visit to Douma with a report to be issued to state parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention. But we have also seen concerning developments elsewhere in Syria. Evacuations from eastern Ghouta were similarly repeated in eastern Khalamun area, southern Damascus, and northern rural Homs. First, military escalation, incoming strikes, airstrikes and artillery, and outgoing towards Damascus, mortars and rockets. Then, that was the pattern, then a negotiation followed by an agreement for the evacuation of those civilians and fighters unwilling to remain under Syrian government control or Russian Federation protection guarantees. We have also seen similar evacuations agreements being discussed in the province of Idlib, but in a completely different format, the reverse format. This time, we are talking about civilians and fighters in government control areas, basically Kefraya and Fua, now considering evacuating, starting with some medical evacuation, after 3 years of siege and intermittent attacks from the armed groups surrounding in that area. Let me share with you also a recurrent concern that I know all of you have. If civilians and fighters are simply just funneled into northern Syria, mostly Idlib, then this might only prove to be a postponement of a further conflict affecting many more people, and I would refer to it later on. Hence the importance of keeping a very close eye on future developments in the Idlib province. Meanwhile, civilians have continued to pay a terrible price. We are talking about 100,000, for instance, 110,000, actually, to be precise, people who have been evacuated to northwestern Syria and Euphrates Shield areas in the past 2 months. Many are reportedly traumatized and in urgent need of assistance and protection. Humanitarian partners are overwhelmed and stretched quite thin by the scale of this evacuation, but continue to do their utmost to respond to the growing needs with your assistance. If we see a junta scenario in Idlib, and here comes the point again of Idlib, this could be six times, I repeat, six times worse, affecting 2.3 million people there, of which half of them are already IDPs and who will have nowhere else to go because there is no other place to go once they are up there. But this is not purely a question of Syrian suffering. We fear that any escalation or substantial escalation in Idlib or in Dara and or in the northeast may also incur risks not only to Syrian civilians, but also to international peace and security. Because, as you know, many of these areas contain external and international forces. Conflict there might entail confrontation with those forces, leading us down to a slippery slope towards regional or potential international conflict. Therefore, international discussions on how to prevent this, on the escalation in particular, are needed and are taking place, but need to be very intense. I was therefore encouraged, I just returned this morning from there, to see concrete discussions on the escalation when I attended the 9th high-level Astana meeting yesterday, particularly on the issue which I referred to, Idlib. Because on that one in particular, the three guarantors do have a say and have a capacity of avoiding it. This round in Astana did see constructive discussions on how this might be achieved, while fully keeping upfront Syria's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. They did engage very actively in front of our own eyes on how to avoid worst-case scenario in Idlib. Also, in Astana, there was the second meeting of the working group on the release of detainees, abductees, the handover of bodies, and the identification of missing people, of which the UN is a member and a very proactive supporter, because that's what many hundreds of thousands of people in Syria are requesting and asking us to do. The working group members held constructive discussions on practical and concrete steps to address this key humanitarian issue. The guarantors informed us that they have secured the support, and that, if confirmed, is good news, of the parties for the activities taking place under the umbrella of the working group, which is a positive development. I hope we'll witness some progress, because so far these are preliminary discussions, we need progress, on this complex issue at the next meeting of the working group, which we heard is going to take place in Ankara. Madam President, the escalation is indispensable. That's what the Syrians themselves are telling us. But it is only one of the ingredients necessary to move on the political process. What we also need is to overcome concrete challenges to a meaningful Geneva process to implement Resolution 2254. As instructed by the Secretary General, I've been consulting with a broad spectrum of relevant stakeholders and proactively identified options for a meaningful relaunch of the UN-facilitated Geneva process. Over 2 weeks, I conducted an exhaustive tour of consultations with the Arab League, members of the Arab League, with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, the EU High Representative, several key European countries, Turkey, the Russian Federation, the Islamic Republic of Iran, with members of this very council, all of you, including this very, in my opinion, productive and useful retreat in Sweden, and with the United States authorities when I came specifically to meet them in Washington a few days ago. And also with the Syrian government and the opposition, which I've been at the meeting because on the sidelines, but very useful sidelines, where they were in Astana yesterday and the day before yesterday. My deputy, Mr. Ramsey, was also in the region this past weekend for continued political contacts with the regional players. And my chief of political affairs, Robert Dunn, has also, while we are talking, traveled to China for exchanges of views with officials of this important member of the Security Council. What did I learn from this long tour? Well, I returned to Geneva with a mixed picture. You will not be surprised. Clearly, there are significant differences still. But, there is also much common ground and common interest on one, the need to de-escalate. On two, to form a constitutional committee under the UN auspices. Three, to facilitate the establishment of a safe, calm and neutral environment, which is then leading to all what we aim at in the political process. Four, to respect Syria's sovereignty, territorial integrity, independence. These commonalities, however, risk getting lost, especially in the absence of serious international dialogue, and I will refer to this. During my tour, this was my message to everyone: robust, strong, proactive, urgent, international dialogue and consensus is now needed more than ever. To create the minimum conditions, for a realistic, credible political process. We know much water has gone under the bridges, much has happened since the 2254 was adopted, so we are getting more and more realistic, but we need a credible political process which takes into account the current situation and does not forget 2254. We are not sitting idle as a secretariat in this regard. We are assessing a number of creative options to update, revive, and advance the Geneva-based political process. And let me put on record that the UN remains mobilized and ready to work on the formation of a constitutional committee according to the Sochi final declaration anytime. I therefore welcome the intention of the Astana guarantors to actively and regularly engage with the UN in Geneva so as to see a concrete follow-up to this declaration 3 months and a half after its adoption. I was also pleased to see a significant number of member states reaffirm the primacy of the UN-led Geneva process in general and the need for a constitutional committee working under UN auspices while I was in Brussels at the EU-UN Brussels conference on 24-25 April. The conference was clearly almost unanimously reiterating the message that the only solution to this crisis will be political, and only this political solution will pave the way for reconstruction efforts. In Brussels, we also saw the entire UN system highlighting the growing needs of millions of Syrians, including IDPs and neighboring countries hosting refugees. Let me also note the important contribution of the Syrian civil society in Brussels. In particular, during a side event organized by the EU and my own office, those present did not shy away from debating with each other, constructively and intensely, on complex issues such as transitional justice and sanctions. They all demanded the release of detainees, abductees and missing people. They all affirmed that any political solution must protect the right of refugees and IDPs. And despite their differences, Syrian civil society. They displayed a genuine commitment to dialogue and spirit of negotiation, what I hope can be replicated in the formal negotiations. In Brussels, I also met with a group of Syrian women activists who stressed that not enough has been done to secure the direct participation of Syrian women in the political process. I committed to translating our collective commitment to this inclusion into concrete measures and will count on your support to keep the promise. For instance, when in future intra-Syrian talks, I will be insisting that a relevant number of seats will be reserved exclusively for Syrian women. When I will be criticized, I hope you will be supporting me, because I know it won't be popular, but needs to be done. Finally, Madam President, let me briefly touch on an issue that was raised by the civil society in Brussels and by many Syrians elsewhere who have been writing to us. That is the possible implication of the newly adopted law number 10. We are quite aware of the concerns surrounding this law, and we and other UN partners are seeking clarifications on the law's goals and repercussions, especially for refugees and IDPs who do not have access to legal documentation. Madam President, let me conclude with two bottom lines. First, the escalation is critical between both the Syrian and international stakeholders, both regional and global. We hope that the relevant players can reestablish some overarching rules of the road in this regard. We stand ready to facilitate such aid discussions with focused support from the Council and key countries for the good offices of the Secretary General and myself. Second, we must revive the political process in terms of constitutional committee, but also in terms of some initial steps towards establishing safe, calm, and neutral environment. We are ready to facilitate discussions on both. And let me stress that a critical component of either aspect of the political process is active, continuous, and positive United Nations engagement with the Syrian parties. I repeat once again, we stand ready, and I'm saying it today, as ever, to engage with the Syrian government in Damascus. We will also continue our contact with the opposition and the Syrian civil society. To unlock these two aspects, careful diplomacy is more than ever required. Careful but proactive diplomacy, including at a high level. Hence, we look with interest at the forthcoming visits to Moscow and meetings of Chancellor Merkel and of President Macron later on with President Putin, which undoubtedly will not be avoiding the issue of a political process in Syria. The United Nations believes that there is an urgent need for high-level diplomacy. One, to support escalation and avoid any miscalculation and ensure a genuine communication system about a sustainable end to the conflict. With the support of the Secretary General, we shall increase our own efforts to contribute to this endeavor, including by offering further ideas and, if required, and we hope it will be required, bridging proposals. I will stop there. Thank you.
Syria's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Mounzer Mounzer, took issue with some of the Mistura's claims and made the following comments through an interpreter.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, at the beginning, the delegations of the US, the UK, have sought to market falsified statements to justify their aggression against sovereign states, particularly against my country, Syria, so as to hide their direct involvement in terrorism sponsoring and the responsibility vis-a-vis the bloodletting in Syria. And I tell them that all the testimonies of thousands of Syrian citizens that have escaped the blockade of the armed terrorist groups in eastern Ghouta, they have testified in the media. All these testimonies prove that you are involved in the suffering of those citizens because you support those terrorist groups. You have proven through your positions, your actions, your malicious actions, and through your occupation, illegal occupation of a number of Syrian territories, you have proven that you cannot let go of your history of greed and occupation and imperialism. In this council, you claim falsely that you seek a political solution for the situation in Syria. And briefly, I tell you, we were able to defeat your agenda in Aleppo, Eastern Ghouta. Likewise, we will defeat you, and you will not be victorious in any area of my country. Madam President, the US, Britain, and France tirelessly worked since the beginning of the terrorist war against Syria. They have tirelessly supported and run this war for 7 years. They have also exploited the UN to be a political tool of pressure against the government of Syria, so that they would implement their hegemonous agenda and they would be able to interfere in our domestic affairs and destabilize my country. They have not used the UN to fight terrorism. This should have been the goal, to fight terrorism and its sponsors and to help the Syrians overcome their suffering due to the practices of the armed terrorist groups. The special envoy dedicated part of his statement to speak of the humanitarian situation. Here, I would like to reiterate that the Syrian government gives primacy to providing all forms of humanitarian assistance to all the affected Syrians, wherever they are in Syria. This is a duty, and we fulfill this duty. Madam President, the legal and constitutional obligation set forth by international points of reference and your resolutions towards combating terrorism has made it incumbent upon my government to undertake military operations in Eastern Ghouta to rescue the civilians from the grip of the armed terrorist groups that did hold them hostage and use them for years as human shields. And here I would like to affirm that, contrary to false narratives, the successful military operations of the Syrian Arab Army and its allies against the armed terrorist groups that did control a number of areas that are classified by the UN as besieged areas and hard-to-reach areas, in addition to the settlement and reconciliation agreements, all have reduced the suffering of civilians and reduced the number of such areas. And it facilitated the humanitarian access, including to Eastern Ghouta. Madam President, we deplore that the U.S. speaks of its keenness to reach a political agreement. Meanwhile, they have committed an aggression based on lies against my country simply because they seek to give support to the armed groups as they have been suffering losses in Eastern Ghouta. The U.S. was the country that supported the Israeli aggression on the 9th of May that came after Israel was not able to provide protection to their own proxy terrorist groups, and they were not able to implement the conspiracy against my country, its unity, territorial integrity, and sovereignty. Israel continues its dangerous aggression, and this would not have been possible without the continued unlimited support by the U.S. government, as it enjoys impunity thanks to the support in the council. This enables Israel to continue its terrorism and threaten international peace and security in the region and the world. The Syrian Arab Republic reaffirms that it is able and ready through its military and armed forces to fend off all aggressions against our sovereignty and independence. However, we would like to reiterate that any attempts to support the failing terrorism would not work. These flagrant violations would not be an obstacle in the way of our fight against terrorism across the Syrian territory. Madam President, yesterday we concluded round 9 of the Astana meeting. We are satisfied with the results of this round. We thank the delegations of Russia, Iran, and the host country, Kazakhstan, for making Astana a success with a view to combating terrorism. And the outcome document of the meeting did stress the unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic against any external entities that violate this. The accomplishments of the Syrian army in cooperation with our friends and allies to liberate eastern Ghouta and the southern area of Damascus has made the capital, Damascus, and its surrounding areas and outskirts safe. We have also expelled the terrorists from the northern ruler areas of Homs, and this was the result of our accomplishments in cooperation with friends and brothers. Here we reaffirm that we continue to fight terrorism and liberate every single area of our territory from terrorism or from countries that are committing aggression against our sovereignty. In conclusion, the government of the Syrian Arab Republic will spare no effort to support all genuine efforts to arrive at a political solution through which Syrians and only Syrians will decide on their future and choices towards safeguarding Syria's sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity. I thank you, Madam President.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The U.S. military is relying more and more on drone warfare. But could this modern weapon be doing more harm than good? Brandon Bryant, a former drone operator in the U.S. military, is with me today to share his experience.
Modern warfare can be fought in mountain passes or down narrow urban streets. But aircraft firing missiles over Afghanistan can now be guided remotely from a base in Nevada. In a dark room lit by computer screens, now by a pilot navigating the skies. What plays on the mind of a drone operator before he hits the button? Is it easier to fight an enemy thousands of miles away instead of face-to-face? And should those who engage in war be distanced from its dangers and consequences?
Brandon Bryant, who served in the U.S. Air Force as a drone operator, welcome to our show. It's really great to have you with us, Brandon. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Brandon, both Obama and Trump have embraced drone warfare with strikes in Somalia and Yemen tripling in number during Trump's first year in office. But the situation in these countries, Afghanistan a prime example, never seems to improve. Can drones really change the course of a campaign?
No, drones definitely cannot change the course of anything, especially if they're being misused as a tool. And that's simply all that they are. And if we take away our ability to interact as human beings with one another, we're never going to solve this crisis.
Now, during your time in the U.S. Air Force, drones were tested as a new form of warfare. Now, even Islamic State have been using them in Iraq and Syria to devastating effect. Do drones have the potential be as commonplace as warplanes and helicopters, and will everyone embrace them at some point?
As this technology gets easier to manufacture, you're going to see a lot more people utilizing it. You can go to a Best Buy in America and buy a quadcopter drone for less than $1,000. And you can watch YouTube videos of people putting stuff on these drones to make them even deadlier. So, you know, it really just takes a more moral and righteous and virtuous person to utilize this technology properly. But obviously what we've been seeing is that none of these people who are using these things in warfare understand what virtues or morals actually are.
Are we going to have like a drone-on-drone combat from now on? Is this how war is going to look like in the future?
Well, if you look at what's happening with Japan and China, they're already utilizing this technology to fight over resources in the ocean. So it's not unheard of that we are going to have cowards fighting cowards behind computer screens.
Now, the biggest plus for using drones is that it saves American lives. Nobody's put in a firing line. So how can the technology be bad? I mean, your side suffers no losses.
That's actually the thing about warfare that people need to understand is that there is a price to pay when going to war. And if we take the human component out of it, then there's no actual price. And then we just continue to the cycle. It's an endless, endless cycle. And there needs to be men and women who train with honor and integrity, who are willing to go onto the battlefield and interact with humans, because that's actually how battles are prevented. Usually we had people posturing one another. Back in World War II, people didn't fire to kill one another. Only 20% people did. Today, in today's conflict, we have a 95% fire and kill rate, and we wonder why we have people with psychological and mental problems that are coming back from home or from war to home and killing themselves. So this is just going to make it even worse.
Now, you have described the use of drones as a cowardly action. I get the view distant warfare was dishonorable.
Correct.
But you can hardly describe homemade IEDs, suicide attacks, or children being recruited to carry them out honorable, right? Wouldn't you back drones knowing your enemy would resort to anything to inflict damage or kill your soldiers?
Just because our enemy does something dishonorable doesn't mean that we need to continue being dishonorable ourselves. This is actually why codes of conduct and codes of honor were required for warriors back in ancient days. It wasn't so our enemies could know what we were doing, but so that we had a structure and boundaries in what we were going to do. Because wars aren't fought against one another, they're fought for the people. And if you can set an example for the people as being the better and nobler and more honorable person, people are going to side with you. And then the enemy will lose their power. And that's really what it comes down to. You take away their ability to recruit. Give the people who are suffering under these conflicts the ability to recover, to feel safe. That's the idea to win this war, not creating better weapons to kill one another.
Yeah, but the point is, there have always been wars and there will be wars, and there's nothing we can do about it, really. So is winning a war less important than being honorable?
That is a poor, poor excuse. That is a poor, poor, poor excuse. Look at the leadership that we have today. Trump is a idiot. And every single person of his administration idiots. And all they ever do is just sit there and posture and saying that we need to go to war and we need to go to war. Obama did the same thing. And we need people who are actual decent human beings saying enough is enough. We have the ability to stop this. We are conscious, living human beings. We're not animals. We need to stop acting like animals and actually be human with one another.
I salute you on that statement, and I wish you ran for president one day. I want to go back to how you become a drone operator. I'm just interested in the whole process. What's the process for becoming one? What kind of people does this role attract, or are soldiers just told they're being transferred?
Well, when I was in the service, I was just transferred because of my aptitude scores. Nowadays, they're... let's just take a look at the people that I worked with. Many of them were the lowest common denominator. When the U.S. military needed people to fill these positions, they just asked a bunch of different careers to send us people. And so the other careers sent us the creme de la mediocrity, if you will, the worst of the worst, people who were rejected from other career fields because they couldn't function in leadership positions. Pilots were moved into drones because they were medically unfit to fly their aircraft. They either couldn't fail or they couldn't be aircraft commanders or squadron leaders, so they were shoved into the program. There were very few people that actually volunteered to be in this program that were of any actual worth as human beings. So this type of society, I guess, within the military culture is sick and degraded, and you know, they're actually looked down upon by aircraft people who actually fly aircraft, because we're flying remotely. They get to wear flight suits. It's a mess. The whole thing's a mess.
What is and the training
they're just putting
like?
People in there to fill positions because they don't need qualification. It's like 3 months.
Yeah,
it's
the like drone operators get just taught just to kill, or are they supposed to be able to tell when to pull the trigger and when to stay stealth?
Oh, no, okay. So we're told that, you know, we get the time to look at our target and to make the discernment of whether we get to kill him or not. But the reality is that if you refuse to pull the trigger, they're just going to take someone out of the seat and put someone in the seat that's going to pull it for them anyway. And how the training works is we're flying over the Nevada desert and we're looking at rocks, and then they're saying, hey, we're going to pretend this rock over here is an enemy. Shine your laser at this enemy. Okay, 3, 2, 1, rifle. 16 seconds time of flight. All right, missile splashes. Enemies killed. You just won the war on terror. Let's pack up and go home. It's just a bunch of imagination that doesn't actually accomplish anything other than to teach people basic toddler skills of hand-eye coordination.
Now, I've read that the operator's schedules are pretty tough and that most of the time you just spend hours looking at nothing. Now, with the messed up sleep cycles and boredom, how sharp are the operators when the time actually comes to make a crucial decision?
Well, this is kind of where the people that I used to work with are pissed off at me, because I exposed the mental difficulties that we were having. You know, we flew in my squadron 11 and a half hour days because we couldn't fly longer than the required crew rest according to Air Force regulations. And in a sense, many of us broke crew rest because we had to do office work, or even some of us couldn't sleep. I was one of those people that couldn't sleep, so I really stopped sleeping. I did this thing called the Easy Man Sleep Schedule, where you sleep every 20 minutes for every 4 hours for 20 minutes, and really screwed me up physically. I was tired all the time. I was exhausted. We had people drinking, and we had this one guy who got into a car accident and rolled his vehicle after drinking, and he used the excuse that he was just tired from work, and he got away with it. It's just a mess. Like people in this world are incredibly messed up, and they refuse to look at themselves and the problems that are going on with them and addressing them.
And then there is, of course, the million-dollar question. I mean, you have firsthand experience of directing warheads to the desired objectives. Tell me this. Are drone strikes really that precise and surgical?
Well, if you're looking at accuracy of where the missile can hit, then yes. If you're looking at the intelligence behind it and how they discern what information that we're given and what targets are correct, then no. In fact, this is what we call secret compartmentalized information. The three-letter agencies that are working as the customer behind the scenes don't really give the people that work, that swing the metaphorical sword, the information, all the information. So they tell us where to swing the sword, but when things go wrong and the wrong people are killed, we're the ones that get blamed because they had all the intel. And
so, Brandon,
it's just a big blame game.
Brandon, where does a drone operator's intel come from? Who is giving you the instruction? As how can soldiers even be sure the information is on point? I mean, does everybody ever question it?
No, well, people don't question it because that's why it's compartmentalized. There's all sorts of different pieces of the puzzle, and none of the pieces are actually talking to one another except for what's required. Knowledge is the modern currency. And so like dragons, they hoard this currency and only divvy it out whatever they think is necessary for them to complete their mission and get more of that currency. It's a weird kind of cycle. And it doesn't really get anywhere, especially with agencies who have this rivalry with one another, and they argue back and forth over who's the better person or who's the better agency or who's cooler. And instead of actually getting the mission done and accomplishing it and finding an end game for the whole thing.
We're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be back with Brandon Bryant, former drone operator in the U.S. Air Force, talking about the heavy toll of drone warfare. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Brandon Bryant, former drone operator with the U.S. Air Force, talking about the implications of drone warfare. Now, Brandon, if you receive intel documenting terrorists, but you look at the screen and think they aren't terrorists, in most cases, would this actually be down to faulty intelligence? Or do you think drone operators are being deliberately misled?
That's kind of another part of the compartmentalized thing. Like, they only give us the information that we need in order to give them the best picture possible and to swing the sword, again, the metaphorical sword. So while we can look at a person and they'll say, follow this person or strike this person, we don't get any more detail than that, really. We can, but the details don't matter, and we're not really sure the sources or anything. Though we are being told that sources come from two places, either signals intelligence, imagery intelligence, or human intelligence, we're not the ones that interact with that information.
How are these extrajudicial killings justified legally? Is it okay to kill someone on suspicion just because you're at war? And can the war on terror be used in an instant or redefine your enemy to keep in those legal parameters?
Well, this is where we get into the grounds of legality versus morality. The Nazis, everything that they did was legal to them. Slavery in the United States, everything was legal. The genocide of Native Americans in my country was legal, right? So where we have to come to the point is, like, where is the moral boundary that we want to draw the line at? And that's something that shouldn't be left to the law. The law is just a framework for us to play in, not a black and white yes or no. And every case is different. I don't think that we should utilize any sort of technology or glorify any technology that is utilized to kill another human being. We still need to see these people as humans, not as demons, because there's a reason why these people are angry and they're hateful. It's not because of anything other than we've created this monster ourselves and we've become the monster that they hate.
Now, in case of civilian deaths as a result of drone strikes, who is held responsible? The drone operator, the commander who gives the order, or the intelligence guys?
Really, no one inside holds each other accountable. If someone screws up, then they just get a slap on the wrist and everything's okay. And that's why you would see in the past when a wrong strike happened, someone like Obama or Brennan would blame the operators themselves for things that are gone wrong rather than the intelligence that was given, because the CIA and all these other agencies that are out there, they don't want to take responsibility. They just want to point up fingers at other people and place the blame on others because they're perfect. They don't make mistakes. It's the operators that make mistakes. And that's actually one of the reasons I started speaking out, was because the operators were just soldiers. And while just following orders is not a good excuse to do it, we're not the ones that have ultimate responsibility in this, though we do have responsibility in what we do.
Do you feel more responsible and more traumatized over your experience than, say, soldiers who serve in the artillery? And why is that? I mean, they launch missiles into war zones. They have feelings. What's so different about being a drone operator?
Well, here's where you get into close combat scenarios versus distant killing. And if we really want to take a look at it, violence and sex affect the same part of the human brain in the exact same way. And hand-to-hand combat is as intimate as you could possibly get with someone. But as you increase the distance from long-range assault rifles or small arms fire, and you get into artillery, you cease actually seeing a human target, and you see actual, like, target locations or target buildings, and you forget about the human being that's a part of it. And if we look at something like World War II and the bombing of Dresden, a lot of those guys, they just pushed bombs out of their aircraft and were just hitting targets. But when they saw the devastation that they caused and the human beings that suffered, many of them were institutionalized, and the instances of PTSD amongst those people were severe. And where it comes from, a difference between an artillery operator and a drone operator, you know, we see our victims. In fact, when we fire a missile, the missile sonic booms about 1.2 seconds after it comes off the rail. And as the kinetic energy is lost through the missile, the sonic boom hits the target first. So we actually see the reaction of the target before missile strikes. And I think that does something to a human being. And I'm speaking from experience and reflection rather than any sort of higher intelligence. So, you know, you can draw your own conclusions in this, but really what it comes down to is seeing how people react in a very human way, knowing that they're about to die, and then killing them from with the finger of God from half a world away is it's a really disturbing feeling. And I would say that, you know, trauma is different across the board, where soldiers on the ground, they experience trauma like an earthquake or a volcano erupting, while we experience trauma as a form of erosion of ourself in a very definitive sense. And even though it might be a slower process, it is very effective in degrading who we feel like we should be.
Now, you have said that you were on Islamic State's hit list, as well as the hit list of a right-wing group in the United States. What makes a drone operator a target for extremes at home and abroad?
See, like, this is the strange thing, is like, I was told that I was on the ISIS hit list by the FBI and Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and I'm not sure how true that is, because I hope that people who see what I'm doing, I'm trying to build a bridge between us so that we can come to an endgame solution and stop killing one another. And this comes from a guy who did it, who has made very grievous mistakes. And I think that the people back home who hate me, you know, they don't want to see anything other than the fear that they're being told. So they're just a bunch of idiots who want to be idiots. And even though I'm the guy with the experience, and I'm the guy that has done the reflection, and I've done the work in order to get this information out there, they still think that I'm a traitor. Well, I can also say that the left called me a monster, so I'm not getting any praise from any group anywhere except for the people who are actually, you know, doing the reflection and the jobs and trying to come up with a solution for this issue. And I think that people who just want to be violent, they're just going to want to be violent, and they're just stupid. You know, any idiot can kill another idiot. It takes a better person to stop hurting another person, because that's where love and kindness come in. That's where all these things are supposed to be utilized, is that you give love to someone when they're unlovable. You're kind to someone when they're not kind to you. It's easy to be kind and loving to someone who's kind and loving to you, but it really takes something special and a lot of effort to give that to people that are not, you don't think are worthy of it.
Now, the Boston Marathon bomber, Jahar Tsarnaev, as well as Faisal Shahzad, who attempted a car bombing in Times Square back in 2010, justify their criminal actions with civilian casualties from American drone strikes in the Middle East. Do you feel that this drone war has produced more terrorists than it has killed, actually?
Of course it's produced more terrorists than has killed. Like, what? How are, like, okay, a lot of these cultures over there, they're warrior cultures. They face their opponents on the battlefield. I grew up as a wrestler, and I know that in Iran, at least, you know, wrestling is a sacred sport. In fact, it's the world's oldest sport. So there's a sense of honor and accomplishment with being able to face your opponent on the battlefield. And even if you're beaten, there is still a sense of honor. But when we're utilizing a technology that no one can fight back, they're going to have to try to find a way to punish us punish us in the sense that they feel is necessary, even though they're wrong. I don't agree with anything that they're doing, but they're responding in a way that they don't feel like they can respond. And that's the cycle of violence. Violence only begets violence.
You know, right now, a drone is guided by operators, and you were one of them, obviously. But could the technology be fully automated? I mean, do you believe there will be robots that can kill humans?
Of course. When I was in Geneva, actually, I was the only American that showed up to this conference of where they're determining the laws that they're going to create for autonomous warfare. And one of the guys that was a proponent of autonomous warfare says that, you know, robots can kill people better than people can because there's no emotion. And I'm really thinking, as someone who's done it, do we really want thoughtless, unemotional things that are able to just end a human being's life indiscriminately? And that's a question that is for the people. And that is something that we need to be considered, because no matter what technology that we use against someone else, that technology can always be reversed and used against us. And that is the balance of things. That's the cycle.
Now, I understand that you were not against drones as a tool, but you say that their use should be transparent. How can this be possible when you're at war? I mean, keeping information classified may mean thousands of lives saved.
That's one of the things that people are confused about, where we have this possibility of things. But the reality of the situation is that lives are being ended. When someone comes to me and be like, well, think about all the American lives that you've saved. Well, that's an invisible number. That's imaginary. You know, if people want concrete, actual fact, I can tell you I have killed 13 people with missile strikes, and there are 1,626 unnamed enemies that were killed in all the missions that I completed. And I know that. I know that for a fact. And I know each of these persons was a human being. They had a family, they had friends, they had lives, and we ended them. The possibilities are endless when you come to the reality of things. And I'm not going to rely on a possibility when the actual evident truth of these technologies being abused is sitting right in front of our goddamn faces.
Oh, wow, Brandon. Thanks for this amazing interview. Truly amazing interview. I wish you all the best with all your future endeavors. We were talking to Brandon Bryant, who used to fly drones for the U.S. Air Force, discussing the rising use of drones by the U.S. military and the dangerous implications of long-distance warfare. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.